The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. And today we're reading from the edition dated July 1st through July 8th, 2011. And our lead story from the magazine this week was taken from online because it happened since the publication went to press last week. The headline, Five Lessons from the Casey Anthony Murder Trial. A Florida jury finds the much-maligned mom not guilty of the murder of her 2-year-old daughter, Kaylee. What can we learn from this high-profile acquittal? Was a Florida jury right to find Casey Anthony not guilty of the murder of her 2-year-old daughter? The answer would be yes, the prosecution didn't prove her guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Or your answer could be no, Anthony may have gotten away with murder. Who cares? It's amazing and troubling how much attention everyone has paid to this case, according to The Week magazine. And the best opinions were presented by the Chicago Tribune, Outside the Beltway, and the Boston Herald, according to The Week. For many of the Americans compulsively following the televised murder trial of Casey Anthony, a Florida mother accused of killing her 2-year-old daughter, the verdict handed down on Tuesday was a stunner. Not guilty on all but 4 counts of lying to the police. Anthony faces up to 4 years in prison when she's sentenced on Wednesday, though she's already served roughly 3 years. Prosecutors had argued that Anthony, 25, drugged, suffocated, and discarded her daughter so she could resume a boisterous social life. The unconvinced jury reached its unanimous 12-0 decision in a short 11 hours of deliberation. What can we learn from this high-profile trial and its verdict? Here are 5 lessons. First of all, our criminal justice system works. A lot of people with less information about the case than the jurors are outraged over the verdict, says the Chicago Tribune in an editorial. But it's time for everyone to swallow hard and say the system worked. The prosecutor failed to prove his case, and justice demands proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It doesn't demand a tidy ending to every story. The jury was certainly correct to uphold our incredibly high standard for proving guilt, says Doug Mataconis at Outside the Beltway. In our legal system, we'd rather see a guilty woman walk than imprison, or worse, execute an innocent one. It's time to scrap trial by jury, the second point in the lessons learned. When it comes to meting out justice, Americans deserve better than any system too stupid to convict Casey Anthony, says Michael Graham in the Boston Herald. And let's be clear, given the evidence, not to mention Anthony's pathological lying, finding her not guilty isn't just an act of criminal stupidity, but also a strong indictment of leaving our criminal justice system at the mercy of 12 yokels too dumb to get out of jury duty. I'd much rather put my fate in the hands of a single corrupt drunken hack in a judge's robe. The third lesson that we might have learned, it's time to scrap trial by Nancy Grace. Anthony's courtroom trial started in May, but cable channels like HLN network have been holding court for 3 years, says James Poniewozik at Time. And HLN head anchor, Inquisitor Nancy Grace, especially, has been blatantly arguing that Casey Anthony was guilty and retribution was due. Given this presumption of guilt, it's no wonder people are upset by the verdict. Grace has been a one-woman, all-supreme TV judge and jury for a long time now, says David Zerowick in the Baltimore Sun, and it has paid off in ratings, so don't expect her to start caring where the facts lie or how her judgments of guilt affect suspects' lives. The fourth point, and what we may have learned from all of this, we're still haunted by O.J. Simpson. It's safe to say we haven't seen this much public outrage over a not guilty verdict since O.J. Simpson was acquitted in 1995, says Dennis Romero at L.A. Weekly. Ironically, without the sky-high ratings for the O.J. Simpson trial, you probably wouldn't even know who Casey Anthony is, says Baltimore Sun Zurowick. The O.J. Anthony comparisons are everywhere, but really this case is an un-O.J. as you can get, says Pat Archbold in the National Catholic Register. Both cases were tried in the media, but while the media case won in O.J.'s case, this time the law won. And the fifth point from lessons learned, the media should be ashamed of itself. Look at any recent high-profile criminal case, O.J., Michael Jackson, maybe even Dominique Strauss-Kahn, and cable's talking heads have blown it every time, says Jeffrey Toobin, as quoted by CNN. In fact, if the saturation media coverage of the Anthony case had any effect, it was in fueling the prosecution's self-defeating decision to seek the death penalty, as if they spent too much time listening to people on cable news being outraged and not enough time evaluating their rather weak evidence. It's sickening, too, says Howard Kurtz at the Daily Beast, that Anthony's case only stands out from the thousands of other child murderers in that the supposed villain is white, middle class, and attractive, the trifecta for producers and bookers. I'm sure there will be more stories about that in the coming weeks. Now, the main story from the printed edition of the week for this week is entitled Obama's Withdrawal Plan for Afghanistan. What happened? President Obama unveiled plans this past week to start bringing troops home from Afghanistan this summer while keeping the bulk of 100,000 troops there for another year. In a speech made as the week was going to press, the president was expected to announce a steeper rate of withdrawal than his generals and senior Pentagon officials wanted, but a much slower pace than demanded by some members of Congress. Under the plan, 5,000 troops would come home this summer, 5,000 more by the end of the year, and at least another 20,000 before the 2012 election. Some congressional leaders have grown increasingly frustrated at the war's $10 billion a month cost at a time when the nation faces record trillion-dollar deficits and major cuts in domestic spending. Will we choose to rebuild America or Afghanistan, asked Senator Joe Manchin, a Democrat from West Virginia. In light of our nation's fiscal peril, we cannot do both. Defense Secretary Robert Gates acknowledged for the first time this week that the Afghan and U.S. governments were in preliminary peace talks with Taliban leaders. Gates cautioned that negotiations would not bear fruit unless the U.S. kept up military pressure. A Pew Research Center poll found growing opposition to the war, with 56% of Americans wanting the troops brought home as soon as possible. And now here's what the editorials had to say. This was a very tough decision for Obama, said the San Francisco Chronicle. He was caught between the hawks led by Gates and his generals and the dovish instincts of Vice President Joe Biden and other liberal Democrats. Biden argued for a faster pullout with special forces and drones focusing on remaining al-Qaeda militants. But the president was clearly persuaded by the argument that if the U.S. were to go home, the Taliban would regain strength, while women's rights and steps toward a more civil society could be erased. A prudent drawdown of troops does not mean abandoning Afghanistan, said the Orlando Sentinel. Let's remember that Obama has tripled the number of troops in the country since he took office. We can't afford the cost of keeping this up, nor can we continue to see U.S. troops dying and being maimed to support Afghan President Hamid Karzai, a corrupt and ungrateful partner. Let's start heading home. Now here's what the columnists had to say. Once again, Obama has chosen to split the differences between the hawks and the doves, said Peter Fever in foreignpolicy.com. The result is a policy that neither fully satisfies nor fully engages, or excuse me, enrages the other side. But on the ground, the military prospects look better than when Obama took office. The surge of 30,000 troops has the Taliban on its heels, while al-Qaeda has been seriously degraded by counterintelligence and persistent drone attacks. Even if the 30,000 troops came home by next year, said Kevin Drum in Mother Jones, we'd still have 70,000 troops in Afghanistan, more than twice as many as were there during the Bush administration. Meanwhile, the CIA says there are only 100 al-Qaeda members left in the country, and Karzai has made it clear he doesn't want us there. Why aren't we arguing about whether we ought to be in Afghanistan at all? The reason we're in Afghanistan, said Max Boot in the Los Angeles Times, is not only to stamp out al-Qaeda, but also to stop it from regenerating itself as it has in the past. That means preventing the Taliban from returning to prominence and projecting power into Pakistan. The smart course of action is to continue to give the surge time work to work. No one, not even General David Petraeus, believes the surge can produce a military victory, said Spencer Ackerman in Wired.com. The real goal is to forge a peace deal with the Taliban, which is why troop withdrawal must proceed slowly. U.S. negotiators need to be able to credibly threaten that the fighting will continue in intensity if the Taliban balks at our terms, while offering faster withdrawal in exchange for concessions. That's the real strategy, and we won't know for about a year if it's working. In other major news this week from The Week magazine, the next item is entitled Syria's Rhetoric Backfires. Massive new protests erupted across Syria this week after President Bashar al-Assad, in a supposedly conciliatory speech, blamed the country's recent unrest on foreign-backed saboteurs and vandals. In his first public address in 2 months, Assad told a crowd of loyalists at Damascus University that he would pursue electoral reform and end 4 decades of totalitarian rule, but he gave no details or time frame. Assad's vague concessions failed to quell the 4-month-old uprising, during which some 1,300 civilians have been killed. In Damascus, 300 demonstrators took to the streets after the speech, chanting no to dialogue with murderers. In neighboring Turkey, where more than 10,000 Syrians have fled to escape the violence, crowds of refugees demanded Assad's ouster, shouting liar. U.S. officials also dismissed the address as mere rhetoric. What's important, said State Department spokesman Victoria Nuland, is action and not words. Assad's address was a desperate last-ditch effort to save an ailing regime, said Max Fisher in The Atlantic. The dictator knows that his military is overstretched and that international sanctions are hitting home. The very fact that he felt compelled to make such a speech, something fellow Arab despots in Egypt and Tunisia did at their lowest points in the battles against the popular protests, is a sign that the situation in Syria, though still bleak, could be rapidly turning. President Obama could speed up that end game by declaring outright that Assad has lost the legitimacy to lead, said P.J. Crowley in the Washington Post. Until now, Obama has granted the Syrian leader the option of implementing reforms or getting out of the way. Now it's clear that Assad will never back any reform that would drive him and his cronies out of business, so we should get off the fence and on the right side of history. Obama has to do more than shake off his cautious stance on the Syrian revolution, said Pathik Root in CNN.com. He has to lead. Only the U.S. can push China and Russia to approve a U.N. Security Council resolution condemning the crackdown and get tough sanctions imposed on the corrupt businessmen propping up Bashar the Butcher. Obama doesn't have the luxury of waiting for someone else to make a move. It's game time. And the next item is entitled, Can Greece Be Saved? Desperate to prevent a default that could throw the global economy into crisis, European leaders this week signaled they would bail Greece out again. But the estimated $64 billion rescue fund following last year's $160 billion will flow only if the Greek parliament approves by next week a painful new catalog of austerity measures, including tax hikes, social spending cuts, and privatization of national industries. The parliament may balk, what with thousands of Greeks outside the building chanting, "Thieves, thieves." Many analysts fear a default could hit global credit and debt markets as hard as the 2008 collapse of Lehman Brothers did. "There's great danger here for the U.S., said the Washington Post in an editorial. "Our economy is too weak to risk a Lehman-like shock, and a Greek default would drive up the dollar, costing us exports and jobs. Yet there's little the U.S. can do about Greece. We are at the mercy of European politics." That's why the Obama administration is prodding the Europeans to deal with the Greek problem swiftly, even if it means slapping on yet another Band-Aid. "Hiding the wound will only give it a chance to get worse," said Newsday. "Greece made this mess by lying about its deficits in order to join the Euro club and then using that currency to underwrite a dysfunctional society in which corruption and tax evasion are rampant. Nearly a third of Greeks work for the state and retire early with generous pensions. The best of the bad choices for Europe is to acknowledge that Greece is bankrupt and keep the crisis from spreading. To do that," said the Wall Street Journal, "Europe should start working now to reward better policies, so vulnerable debtors like Ireland and Portugal live within their means and don't become the next Greece. Greece can't avoid a default, and its people can't avoid a painful reckoning. The question now is whether others can learn from its painful lesson soon enough to avoid a similar fate." And the controversy of the week from The Week magazine, Libya, win a war isn't really a war. Is the Obama administration in violation of the War Powers Resolution, asked the New York Post in an editorial. That 1973 statute gives the president the power to launch a military campaign so long as Congress approves the action within 90 days of the start of hostilities. President Obama committed U.S. troops and equipment to the NATO campaign in Libya more than 90 days ago, yet is refusing to ask Congress to authorize the action. His rationale? Because the U.S. is merely supporting NATO with no ground troops involved and no active exchanges of fire with hostile forces. "We're simply conducting limited military operations in Libya, not hostilities." The anti-war left, as well as some Republicans, including presidential candidates Mitt Romney and Michelle Bachmann, aren't buying that absurd argument. 10 members of Congress, led by Representative Dennis Kucinich, a Democrat from Ohio, last week sued Obama in federal court to challenge his continued use of U.S. forces. "The immediate question is not whether the U.S. should be fighting in Libya," said Jonathan Schell in the Los Angeles Times. "It's why the president is flouting the law. U.S. planes and unmanned drones are dropping bombs in a foreign country, and the bombs are killing and injuring people and destroying things. Sounds like a war to me." "That it somehow isn't one is a ridiculous position," said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post, "and the only explanation is that Obama wants to avoid a debate over the U.S.'s continued military involvement." But there are real moral and strategic issues that deserve full airing and Congress's input. What about the civilians who are being killed accidentally? Assuming Gaddafi is eventually deposed or killed, then what? Will we be stuck with another ruinously expensive exercise in nation-building? "There's more at stake here than Libya," said James Fallows in the Atlantic.com. "Even if Obama's Orwellian word games have kept him from violating the War Powers Resolution, the central concern and the major threat to our politics is that once again we are going to war essentially on one person's say-so. Obama's motives in Libya may be pure and the cause may be just, but by seizing for himself the power to declare war single-handedly, he's setting a very dangerous precedent for future presidents whose motives and judgment may not be as good. This issue has split the GOP, said George Will in the Washington Post, with Senator John McCain this week denouncing the isolationist strain in the Republican Party. But you don't have to be an isolationist to doubt the value of bogging down U.S. troops in another unwinnable, unaffordable foreign misadventure. Obama's handling of the Libyan conflict has been marred by indecision and half-measures, said Colin Dweck in the NationalReview.com, but we're in it now, and once warfare is initiated, the most important thing to do is to win. Defunding the Libyan war might gratify conservatives by inflicting a huge defeat on President Obama, but it would also damage U.S. prestige around the world. Nonetheless, Obama's verbal games do not get him off the hook, said the New York Times in an editorial. The president has a legal and ethical responsibility to get congressional approval to keep fighting in Libya until Gaddafi's tyrannical government falls. Congress should then give him that authorization. Pulling out now and letting Gaddafi crush a legitimate uprising by force would be hugely costly for this country's credibility, for the future of NATO, and for the people of Libya. And now we'll turn from the more serious side of the news to the funnier side of the news with the popular column entitled Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4 from the Week magazine for this week. The first item, it was a good week for poop power after the Toronto Zoo agreed to send 3,000 tons of feces from rhinoceroses, giraffes, bison, and other animals to a new biogas plant. The power plant will convert the zoo's poop and food waste into heat, electricity, and fertilizer. It was a good week for hugging after Brian Feldman, a Florida conceptual artist, spent Father's Day giving his dad a 24-hour hug while the two stood in a boxing ring. Feldman called it both a healing and a transformative experience. And it was a good week for Sarah Palin, Inc., after the former Alaska governor registered a trademark on her name, barring others from using it for commercial or political marketing unless they pay her for the privilege. It was a bad week for Buddhist jokes after the host of an Australian TV show tried to make the Dalai Lama crack up by telling him a joke. The Dalai Lama walks into a pizza shop and says, "Can you make me one with everything?" The Dalai Lama, apparently confused by the reference to pizza, looked at him blankly. It was a bad week for just following orders after a Washington State woman drove her SUV down a boat ramp and into a lake because her GPS told her to. The woman and two passengers were able to swim to shore safely. And it was a bad week for listening to your own impulses after the Portland, Oregon Water Bureau drained a reservoir of 7.8 million gallons of drinking water after a 21-year-old Joshua Cedar urinated into it. "I had a pleasant buzz and I should have known better," Cedar admitted. Now from the Week magazine for this week, let's turn to the People section. The first item is entitled, Bono's Take on Spider-Man. "Bono isn't used to failure," said Patrick Healy in the New York Times, "but even he admits to being deeply disappointed in Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark, the $75 million musical that finally opened last week." He and U2 bandmate The Edge first began collaborating with renowned director Julie Taymor on the music for the show back in 2002, a decision he regrets. "The hours and weeks and months, if we thought it would take this long and there's not a chance on earth, we'd have done it." Despite Taymor's struggles with her ambitious vision, Bono says he retained faith in her talent. "We read her script. We were part of developing that script. We thought it was great. But when the show opened in previews, critics savaged its plot as incoherent and boring." In hindsight, Bono admits he found the plot obtuse and wishes he'd spoken up about his doubts. "Julie was clearly exhausted, overwrought, and we all thought that if we don't tread carefully, she's going to walk. I certainly didn't feel I could be 100% frank with Julie. Now that Tamor has been fired and the show rewritten, Bono thinks it's better, but says it's still a work in progress. The first time I loved Spider-Man, he says, was 2.5 weeks ago. The show, of course, has now reopened on Broadway. The next item, the boxer who lost his career to crack. Tony Suggs could have been a contender, said Bridget Schulte in the Washington Post magazine. The former boxer was once the top-rated lightweight in the country and was just one fight away from qualifying for the 1988 Olympic Games. Shy and unimposing at 5'7" outside the ring, he fought with fury once the bell rang, scoring knockouts in 116 of 138 amateur fights. All I wanted to do was hurt somebody, he says. A lot of times I would feel sorry for an opponent after a fight. The rage he knows now was a response to the physical and sexual abuse he'd experienced growing up in a chaotic family. But he also used drugs to cope with his pain, and when his infant daughter died of sudden death infant death syndrome, he took up crack cocaine. It was like I didn't care anymore. I wanted to mess up my life. At 21, on the eve of qualifying for the Olympics, he was arrested for drug possession. He then spent years bouncing in and out of jail. When he finally got out, the rage was gone. Now 44, he's training his 25-year-old son, Anthony, to be the boxer he never was. I feel that it is my job to help someone else make it to the Olympics. I don't think God allowed me to go through what I went through without a reason. And the next item from People, the Oprah of Afghanistan. Mojda Jamalzada is the world's toughest talk show host, said Fariba Nawa in the London Times. Born in Kabul and raised in Vancouver, British Columbia, she returned to Afghanistan in 2009 to start a talk show called The Mojda Show. With Oprah Winfrey as her model, she addresses taboo topics such as divorce and domestic abuse. A real man, she said on one show, wouldn't hit his wife. A shocking statement there. The subjects are controversial, concedes Jamalzada, who is 26 years old, by the way. But Afghans are into it. In a country where all TV was banned by the Taliban, she has to tread carefully. I have to choose conservative clothes. For one episode, I didn't have a headscarf and my collarbone was showing. The government temporarily canceled the show. Off the set, Jamalzada carries a gun for protection. I received threats from men and women. One said someone should put a bullet in her head. She's a disgrace to Afghans. We should rape her. She's determined to keep going. One woman on the show told us her husband stopped hitting their kids after he saw our program on child abuse. Another told her that her husband hadn't hit her since he watched Jamalzada's show on domestic violence. I can see that I am making a difference. And you're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks so much for joining me today. Now let's turn to the briefing section from the week, dated July 8, 2011. And this one is entitled, Blades of Glory, What's Behind America's Obsession with Velvety Green Weed-Free Lawns? Why do we have lawns? Well, whether we know it or not, we're imitating European royalty. The first lawns were created by the nobles and aristocrats of the 17th and 18th century Europe, including Louis XIV of France, whose Versailles gardens were the first to include squares of tapis vert, or green carpet. The idea of lawns as status symbols and pleasure grounds caught on among French and British landed gentry, who relied on servants, sheep, and goats as lawnmowers. After the American Revolution, the trend hopped the Atlantic and flourished among the new nation's landed aristocrats. George Washington had an English-style lawn at his home in Mount Vernon, as did Thomas Jefferson and Monticello. Front lawns didn't really trickle down to the common man until the development of suburban housing after the Civil War, said Virginia Scott Jenkins, author of The Lawn, A History of an American Obsession. With World War II's end and America's mass exodus from cities, lawns became emblems of American leisure and prosperity, and a burden for generations of homeowners. Why take all that trouble to grow grass? A well-kept lawn is an outdoor refuge, a place for touch football and summer parties, a carpet all alive, said the poet William Wordsworth. Writer Catherine White called the lawn a soft mattress for a creeping baby that adds restful green perspectives to the landscape. Realtors say a nice lawn adds as much as 11% of the value of a home. Beyond curb appeal, tidy lawns are the connective tissue of the neighborhoods, providing a common element that links our residences to one another and to nature. And researchers have recently discovered that chemicals released by a freshly mown lawn make people feel happy and relaxed, and may even prevent mental decline in old age. Today, about 80% of all American homes have lawns, but great sacrifices of time, energy, money, and natural resources go into mowing, trimming, edging, and feeding all that grass. As Little Richard once said, the grass may look greener on the other side, but believe me, it's just as hard to cut. Well, what does a nice lawn cost? Lawn care is a $40 billion a year industry in the United States. Because much of the country is not hospitable to turf grasses, none of which are native species, we use 90 million pounds of fertilizer and 78 million pounds of pesticides annually just to keep lawns thriving, bright green, and bug-free. Lawns also consume massive amounts of water, more than U.S. farmers use to grow wheat or corn or any other agricultural crop. The Environmental Protection Agency estimates that one-third of all water from public sources goes toward landscaping, most of it on grass. In tropical Florida, half of the public water is used for landscaping. In the western states, where water is especially scarce, that figure is 70%. Do lawns hurt the environment? Yes, in numerous ways. Fertilizers contain high levels of phosphorus and nitrogen, which run off into drains during rainstorms, contaminating drinking water, leaching into rivers and streams, and causing ecological havoc. Pesticides and herbicides, too, which are used by homeowners in ever-increasing quantities, find their way into the air and the soil. Then there's the carbon footprint of the lawn. Americans spend more than 3 billion hours a year pushing or riding gasoline-powered lawn and garden equipment that gives off toxic exhaust and greenhouse gases. A gas-powered mower emits as much pollution per hour as 11 cars. These facts have triggered a backlash against the country's love affair with large, immaculate swaths of green grass. We have begun to recognize that we are poisoning ourselves with our lawns, said author and activist Michael Pollan. Has the backlash been effective? To a small degree, though there has been no reduction in the acreage of new lawns being planted, activists have raised awareness so that lawn care is less destructive. In Canada, more than 100 cities have banned or restricted pesticide use on private property. This year, New York banned pesticides and herbicides on school lawns and playing fields, and Maryland limited the nutrient content of lawn fertilizer and when it may be applied. In the West, more communities are replacing turf with indigenous plants. In the high desert country of Clark County, Nevada, home of Las Vegas, lawns are now banned from the front yards of new homes. What is the future of the lawn? The perfect lawn is in peril, said Ted Steinberg, an environmental historian. That's a good thing, according to groups like Wild Ones, the first grassroots anti-lawn advocacy group. There are saner organic alternatives, low-maintenance ground cover, walkways, and gardens. Freedom lawns use no chemicals or extra water and need very little mowing. But there are even more natural solutions. Last week, school officials in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, turned over the district's lawn care to a herd of hungry sheep, saving $15,000 a year in landscaping costs. And the footnote to this briefing article is entitled, The War Against Weeds. Half of all the plants growing in America have been classified as weeds. The federal government even publishes a noxious weed list. But what makes a plant a weed? Weeds are plants that sabotage human plans, said Richard Mabee, a naturalist and author. On that very long list are dandelion, clover, crabgrass, and a myriad of botanical eyesores that steal nutrients and ruin a lawn's uniformity. At great expense of money and effort, humans have declared war against thousands of weed species in the United States, from the most notorious, like poison ivy, to plants that are actually pretty, such as the corn poppy. It's a battle we can never really win, since evolution has taught plants, including those we classify as weeds, to spread their seeds on the wind. Weeds flourish wherever we clear land, dig, or farm. Human activity has even backfired to create super weeds like Kogan grass, which flourished in Vietnam when Agent Orange wiped out its natural enemies. Today, having somehow crossed the Pacific, Kogan grass is taking over large sections of the southeastern U.S. Now let's listen to the best columns in the United States this week, according to The Week magazine. Our first column is entitled, Pinning the Blame on Fannie Mae. Looking for someone to blame for the 2008 economic meltdown, asked David Brooks. It all started with Fannie Mae, the government-backed mortgage giant, and its former chief executive, James Johnson. In a well-reported new book, Reckless Endangerment, Gretchen Morgenson and Joshua Rosner reveal how Johnson, a Democrat sage with a raft of prestigious connections, enriched his friends and made $100 million for himself by flooding the market with risky subprime mortgages. Dispensing with the usual criteria for making loans, Fannie handed out billions in federally guaranteed dollars like candy and helped spread risky behavior and low standards across the housing industry. Johnson and his cronies paid themselves lavishly and used Fannie funding to lobby congressmen, falsify academic research, and suck in reputable figures such as Bill Daley, Ken Starr, and Larry Summers to defend Fannie's scam. In the end of it all crashed, bringing big banks, Wall Street, and the entire economy down with it. Yet Johnson and the other power players skated away blameless. This is how Washington works. Is it any wonder there's such a growth market for angry populism? That, according to David Brooks in the New York Times. Our next column is entitled Working Class Whites Will Decide 2012 by Rye Texera, the New Republic. The 2012 election will be decided by a single critical factor, said Rye Texera. Will white working class voters totally abandon President Obama? Blue-collar whites have been the bulwark of every GOP victory going back to Richard Nixon in 1968, and they are a pessimistic, even angry mood. A recent poll found that only one-third of working-class whites thought that today's children would have better lives than they do. Not surprising, the Republican battle plan for 2012 is to persuade gloomy Americans that Obama is unable to fix the economy. If that message produces a white working class surge toward the GOP, it could tip the balance in the states where the election is actually decided. Swing states such as Ohio, Florida, Nevada, and Colorado. In 2008, Obama lost the white working class vote by 18 points, but won the election because of his huge advantage among non-whites and urban elites. Next year, Obama could conceivably lose the working class by 30 points, and that might sink him. And the next and final best column from this week in The Week magazine, The Triumph of Irrational Dogma by Fareed Zakaria in Time. What's happened to conservatism? Asked Fareed Zakaria. It used to be a hard-headed philosophy rooted in a realistic assessment of human nature, but in recent years it's morphed into a dogmatic insistence on a set of abstract principles for which there is no evidence. Conservatives now have one prescription for all problems: cut taxes, shrink government. But tax rates are now at their lowest level since 1950, and the U.S. has lower taxes than almost all the other big industrial nations. Germany and Denmark have much higher tax rates, but their economies are booming. So are China's and Singapore's, despite their government's heavy involvement in directing economic growth. Our own economy was healthiest in the 1950s and 60s, when the U.S. government made massive investments in science and technology, in public universities, and in new industries. Conservatives ignore history and the evidence from around the world, insisting even that the U.S. budget deficits can be eliminated simply by cutting taxes further. It's nonsensical. But like the Marxists of old, today's doctrinaire conservatives are so in love with theory that the real world is irrelevant. And now we'll turn to the back of the magazine for this week. The last word in the Week magazine. This week's article is entitled, When AIDS Was New. In the epidemic's early days, Bill Hayes asked a lost generation to create a time capsule. He just opened it. It is difficult now to call up the particular mood that prevailed in the AIDS epidemic's early years. I'm not talking about the first rumblings when no one knew enough to be afraid, but further in those post-AZT pre-antiretroviral drug days, there was very little one could do if infected. Primitive prophylaxis against certain diseases offered one's best, but certainly no guarantee that one wouldn't die of Kaposi sarcoma or cytomegalovirus or pneumocystis carginii pneumonia. The idea of life without AIDS, much less of being alive in 30 years, was almost unimaginable. Which is why in the late 80s, co-workers and I at the San Francisco AIDS Foundation came up with an idea to get people, gay men in particular, thinking about the future. We decided to create a time capsule that would house answers to a simple question. What message would you send to people 50 years from now about your experiences during the epidemic? In June of 1990, we set up a booth at the San Francisco Gay and Lesbian Pride Parade. Crowds cheered marchers nearby on Market Street, yet the mood was somber within our humid vinyl tent. I saw a steady flow of men waiting patiently in a line that did not shorten until the parade ended and the fog rolled in. Single men, couples, and groups of friends, pumped up, sunburned, half-undressed young men propped on canes and leather daddies in wheelchairs, all waiting to send a note to the future. I left the AIDS Foundation well over a dozen years ago, and I moved from San Francisco to New York 2 years back. I have no idea whether the AIDS time capsule has survived safely someplace. Our idea of a capsule was a taped-up cardboard box. Fortunately, however, before we packed up the more than 500 messages, I made Xerox copies of a number of them. I have carried them with me since, a time capsule of a time capsule. On the occasion of the 30th anniversary of AIDS on June 5th, I pulled them out for the first time in 2 decades and took a look at them. Words sputtered from the first page in a tangled cursive script. This is one effing hellish experience. You are very lucky to be born after the plague is over. The next was written in meticulously printed letters. When you hear about an epidemic or even a little mention of something strange happening, act immediately. Don't wait for authorities. Another sheet was simply covered with tiny pencil-drawn tears. The handwriting often revealed as much as the words themselves, hurried scrawls, nearly illegible, filled with childlike misspellings. Words underlined once, twice, three times until the paper tore. Tiny graphite explosions where snapped pencil points gave the fifth exclamation mark more urgency. Some rambling messages completely filled the page. Others drifted calmly, dead center, were short and bittersweet. My heart was broken when my boyfriend died. I will never recover. I moved from Seattle to Castro as if to another country in July of 1985, right at the time when Rock Hudson died and every newspaper was filled with stories about the deadly virus. I was 24. I had come out to my family about a year before, though I'd been sexually active since I was a teenager. When I told my father I was moving to San Francisco, ground zero in the epidemic, he said he thought I might as well commit suicide. But I was ecstatic to be at the center of it all, living in a ratty flat off Diamond Street with four roommates, three cats, and a spectacular view of the city. Terribly familiar with the strange new illness, some men I knew seemed able to sense it from blocks away, like changing weather. Even in the earliest stages, when only the new HIV antibody test provided proof. It was that look, they called it, nothing more. Their intuition fascinated me until I shared it. After a couple of years and a couple of friends' deaths, I acquired this skill, too. AIDS has changed my life forever. It is hard to think of that time when AIDS will not be a big hole where my friends were. It was the predictability of the plotline, not the disappearing characters, that gradually became most frightening. Every time one story abruptly ended, another instantly started, on a loop. I remember that my friend Peter had just died when I visited another friend, Jeff, to bring him some food. He had just been released from the hospital. In pain from persistent headaches and weakened by diarrhea, Jeff had staged a suicide attempt in his doctor's waiting room so that he would be admitted to the hospital on the spot without several hours' delay. Now he was staying with Stuart, who had what at the time was called ARC, AIDS-related complex, and was in the sixth week of a hunger strike to protest the meager federal AIDS funding. This was the winter of 1986. Opening the front door to their apartment was like cracking open an oven turned to 450 degrees. I immediately began unpeeling layers of clothing. Stuart was propped on the couch, wrapped in a sleeping bag, shivering between two plump older men. With his blonde hair, emaciated face, and wire-rimmed glasses, he looked like a medicated pilgrim. The room was lit by a collection of seven or eight electric space heaters that crackled, hissed, and wheezed, bursting on and off, and cast a warm orange glow on the floor. It was as though I had wandered into a weird underworld chapel. No one spoke a word. The only thing on the wall was a giant calendar marking Stuart's countdown, covered with X's. The door had disappeared behind me in the darkness. Standing there, I felt for one delirious moment the final terror of illness. Horribly, inescapably trapped, just like Jeff and Stuart, trapped in life, in a body unready to die and desperate to jump out of it. I thought if I join the other two men quietly waiting their turn on the couch, if I make myself at home here, I will never leave this apartment. I found my way to the kitchen, placed the food in the empty refrigerator, then looked in on Jeff, who was sleeping. The last image I have of him alive is in that dim hothouse bedroom. In spite of the heat, he was sprawled diagonally atop the bed, face down, wearing a hat, gloves, and a winter coat, as if he had fallen in knee-high snow and couldn't get himself up again. Loss, loss, loss. The pain of loss, the relief of the unscathed, the loneliness of being the survivors. Faces of the dead surfaced weekly in the Bay Area Reporter, a local gay newspaper that published obituaries with photos of men who had recently died. Picking up a copy, I would instinctively open first to this section. It filled two pages or more. I always recognized someone I had known, danced, slept, or worked out with, aware that in a barely different narrative, one of the pictures could have been my own. For a while, I saved the obituaries and other evidence of an ephemera from the epidemic. ACT UP meeting agendas, a Polaroid photo, passed among friends, a Kaposi sarcoma symptoms. A flyer that simply said, imagine a cure. A gay paper personals ad that proposed, we'll trade AZT for Seconal. As an HIV-negative gay man, I suppose I felt a sense of duty to be an archivist for my community. Yet when I fell in love with a man who was HIV-positive, I threw the yellowing papers away. Keeping up with every treatment of the month seemed a daunting task, and the flattening files in our bedroom only served to remind me of the burgeoning death tolls, upon which I was determined not to dwell. This was 1989. The worldwide pandemic was more than a news story now. It was in my house, in Steve's body, in our life. I won't be afraid of infecting my lover who is HIV negative, or of becoming a burden should I get ill. We stood together, supported each other, sure that the answer would come, but skeptical too, tired of waiting. That it did actually come one day in the form of protease inhibitors. And for Steve, in the nick of time, never failed to seem miraculous. True after 4 or 5 years, by which point Steve had regained his lost health, his T-cells steady and his viral load now undetectable. We, like so many with access to these drugs, breathed more easily. But there was never a sense of complacency, of forgetting. How could there be? For this part, Steve had to take the pills on a strict schedule every day, switch medications from time to time, cope with side effects, get blood work regularly, and so on. For mine, I was always acutely aware that with one unsafe slip or accident, I could find myself on a drug cocktail, too. Before Steve, I had never pictured myself in a relationship. Lovers, sex, romance, yes, but to pair off with one person and make a life together? No. And then, because of AIDS, I never presumed that our relationship would last long enough to be truly long-term. What I got so unexpectedly, however, I also unexpectedly lost. One morning, 5 years ago, I awoke to a great thrashing, as if the San Andreas had finally given way. Steve, in bed beside me, was having a heart attack. I called for help, began CPR. EMTs came. They got him to the ER, but by then he was gone. What it is to be happy will never be the same. No one could quite explain it in a heart attack. He was just 43, in good shape physically. There was no family history of heart disease. The autopsy and toxicology reports revealed little. Now, finally, the answer I've long suspected has come. A study published in the Archives of Internal Medicine and picked up by Newswires last month confirmed that infection with HIV increases the risk of a heart attack, perhaps because of the virus itself, perhaps as a result of the antiretroviral drugs. As I write this from my new home in New York on the 30th anniversary of the first reported cases of AIDS, I see the world poised on a delicate threshold. We have achieved so much. Scientists have made discoveries that would have been unthinkable when we made the AIDS time capsule. Countless lives have been saved. And yet the pandemic continues. In the developing world, in particular, efforts at prevention have failed to stem the tide of new infections. Every day, more than 7,000 people become infected. Which is not to say they're all over there. 2 months ago, a friend my age, 50, confided to me that he had recently seroconverted. He is going to be okay. He's already on ARVs. But he was as ashamed and distressed as if not a day had passed since the 1980s. I cannot help but wonder what those men and women waiting in that line to write notes to the future world would say. Here we are, 3 decades in, no cure, no vaccine yet, and no end in sight. Yes, treatment works, but there is never going to be enough money to support the cost for all who need it. Have hope. Have faith. Keep struggling and fighting for your dreams. I returned the handful of messages to the tattered manila envelope in which they had been stored, placed it back in a cardboard box in my bedroom closet, and pushed the door closed. As I do so, I am reminded of some of the quieter voices inside the time capsule. Look back and wonder. Prepare for the next time. Do not forget us. That article written by Bill Hayes, copyrighted 2011, in the New York Review of Books, excerpted by permission. And now we have just a few moments left in our program today. Let's take a look at a couple of short items from Talking Points in the Week magazine. The first one, homework, parents lead a rebellion. What are we doing to our kids, asked Candy Shulman in the Washington Post. From preschool to pre-college prep classes, schools trying to meet tough testing standards have turned them into a pressure cooker, which stressed out kids buried under tons of homework. Some grade schoolers take home 2 hours of work a night, and my 16-year-old high school junior is swamped with so much work, she can't even find the time to take a walk. To prepare for 6 exams in 5 days, she recently locked herself in her room from Friday to Sunday. I fear for our children's health. That fear is propelling a nationwide homework revolt, said Winnie Hugh in the New York Times. Parents leading the rebellion say too much homework is depriving kids of exercise and fun, and they want limits imposed, especially for weekends and summers. Parents want their kids back, one school official says. Why not ban homework altogether, said the press of Atlantic City in an editorial. And tests, too, pardon our sarcasm, but while it may be pointless to give a second grader 2 hours of homework, high school students do benefit from extra hours of assignment. How can an English teacher delve into Faulkner or Joyce, said college student Jonathan Lay in collegenews.com, if students don't spend hours outside of class reading their novels? How do you teach a foreign language if students don't learn the vocabulary at home? Because of my own experience as a student, I believe in homework, and so do China, India, and other competitors in the global marketplace. Maybe we should stop obsessing about China and standardize tests too, said Nicole Pelton and TechMorata.com. Thanks to No Child Left Behind, teachers are now forced to cover a pre-assigned list of topics rather than stimulate students. I've actually seen the light go right out of a kid's eye when they had to stop reading a book to fill out a bubble on a worksheet. Too much homework and the pressure that comes with it is tearing apart the American family, said Ali Skylar in NJ.com. When my husband and I get home from work, we're forced to police our burned-out kids' nightly homework grind. I'd rather eat a leisurely meal with my children and then enjoy some free time as a family. Do we want our kids to be anxious, sedentary, automatons with straight A's, or healthy, happy, and well-balanced? And a few short items here to conclude our program. The top 0.1% of earners in the U.S. take in more than 10% of the personal income, with business executives leading the way. The income of the wealthiest executives has soared 400% since the 1970s, while for most workers it has stalled. Cancer rates are twice as high among the least educated Americans as among those with graduate degrees. Cancer experts say the poorly educated are more likely to smoke, eat unhealthful food, and lack health insurance. And the poll watch for today, 53% of Americans say sexting, exchanging sexual communications over the Internet or via cell phones, while in a relationship, is cheating. 17% say it isn't, and 30% say that it simply depends on the circumstances. Well, we have just about run out of time for our episode of The Week magazine this week. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed the program. I'm George Douglas, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast right after the broadcast. So long, until next time.